Welcome to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host today, Monica Hadley. Our guest on Writer's Voices is Ziva Bukai, who was born in Israel and raised in New York City. Her honors include a fellowship at the New York Center for Fiction and multiple residencies. Her stories are forthcoming in the anthology Smashing the Tablets, a radical retelling of the Hebrew Bible, and have appeared in many publications. Her work has been featured on the Stories on Stage Davis podcast. She studied acting at Tel Aviv University, holds a BFA in theater and an MFA in fiction from Brooklyn College, is the assistant director of academic support at SUNY Empire State University, and lives in Brooklyn with her family. I'm not sure where she finds time to do all of this. But the book that we are talking about today is The Anatomy of Exile. Welcome to Writer's Voices, Ziva.
Thank you so much for having me, Monica. I'm really pleased to be here.
Now, is this your first novel?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
It's my debut novel.
Your debut novel that's published. Now, I always have to ask, is it the first one you wrote or just the first one you've published?
The first one I've published. Okay. I wrote another novel a few years ago, and that one made it as far as an agent and went out into the world, but never found a publisher.
And what do you think you learned from that that enabled you to find a publisher this time around?
I think I learned how to sustain a story for a much longer period of time through that first novel. That first novel was really a teaching tool for me.
Right.
I kind of learned how to do it. But if you ask me, like, how do you write a novel? I mean, it's really one sentence at a time, right? But it's also about trying to keep an entire story in your head and sustain a narrative arc, meaning you need to grow a character. How does the character grow from the beginning to the end? And in that first novel, I don't think that was, you know, I was just trying to tell a story. I wasn't thinking about narrative arc or how the character was growing.
Okay.
And changing.
So now, does this mean that when you sit down to write a novel, you know how it's going to end?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. Honestly, I write by the seat of my pants. You know, there are people who plot everything out. I have a dear friend who writes mystery novels, and so she plots everything out. For me, I kind of start off with a mood or an idea, and I want to see where it's going to take me. And the journey for me is what's really interesting, the development of the characters, how they're changing, the development of the story itself, how they're moving from one place to another. All of that is interesting. And I wasn't exactly sure how it would end, but I knew that it would end where I began, essentially, in the place where it begins, where the story, where Anatomy of Exile begins, is where I thought this is where it has to end also.
Okay. So what was the inspiration for the Anatomy of Exile? Or maybe tell us a little bit about what the story's about, and then and then why you wrote this story.
So The Anatomy of Exile is about an Israeli family who has a terrible tragedy occur in their lives after the Six-Day War. A beloved aunt is killed in what appears to be a terror attack, but is actually a crime of passion between her and between this Jewish Israeli Syrian aunt who lives in Israel and a Palestinian man who was a poet and an engineer and who lived on the same land as Hadass, as this particular family did as well. Tamar is the main character. It is her sister-in-law who's killed at the beginning, and her husband Salim decides that he is going to move the family to America for 5 years, make $1 million, and come back rich as a king to Israel. And of course, that's not what happens, right? It being in America is difficult for the family to navigate, difficult for Salim to navigate. most especially for Tamar, who only longs to go home. And it is about how the family deals with being in America. And of course, irony of ironies, a Palestinian family moves in upstairs, and Tamar's daughter, Ruby, who is 17, falls in love with Faisal Mahmoudi, the Palestinian boy upstairs. And Tamar is terrified that history is going to repeat itself, and she does everything she can to break up this relationship. And in the process, winds up almost destroying her marriage, the relationships that she has with her children, and basically her own identity and self as how she sees herself as a mother, as a wife, as a human being on the planet. So basically that's the story, this idea of history repeating itself and how the family navigates America. This story is not autobiographical. However, there are things that dovetail with my own family history, and the fact that I came here with my parents when I was almost 4 years old and grew up in the U.S. and always felt like I was both inside and outside, right? Mm. Both an American, but not quite an American, both an Israeli, but not quite Israeli. And so this idea of the outsiderness was something that I really wanted to explore.
So Salim and Hadass were Arab Jews.
Correct.
Which is sort of an unfamiliar concept, I think, to a lot of us in the United States.
Absolutely. So there were 800,000 Arab Jews across the Middle East and North Africa, where after 1948, between 1948 and like 1968, those 20 years after the establishment of Israel, that they were basically expelled, exiled from their countries. Again, this sort of dovetails with my own history in the fact that my father was born in Damascus and came to Israel in the early 40s, before 1948, before the establishment of Israel, when Israel was still Palestine. Actually, British Mandate Palestine. I think people forget that as well. And he crossed the border with two young brothers into Israel. He was smuggled across the Golan Heights and then placed on a moshav, and his two brothers were placed on kibbutzim, which are kind of communal, kind of like what we would consider a commune here. But right. they were these communes where people worked the land together, built their homes together, ate together, all of that.
We're familiar with the kibbutz, but the first where your father was, what was that?
Right, a moshav. So a moshav was a little bit different in the sense that it was a farming community. People didn't eat together. They had their own houses, and everybody had their own small plot of land. But it was a community, like a village, basically.
Okay. And how old was your father?
My father was 13
and
when he left home.
And he came without his parents?
Absolutely, yeah.
Wow.
He came without his parents. Well, his parents were really trying to save their lives.
Yeah.
They were trying to save their children's lives. And they sent their children out. Like the eldest daughter left first and made it to Israel. And then my father and two of his brothers, one was 11, the other 8.
Wow.
So he was responsible for them. And they were basically smuggled across by the Jewish British Brigade and then brought into Israel. And this was all part of a program called the 1,000 Children, Operation 1,000 Children. And Operation 1000 Children was an effort to save the lives of Jewish Syrian children in the 40s.
So how did your father's family end up being Jewish in Syria? You know, how did that happen?
That's a good question. There were Jews in Syria from biblical times. My father's family, I think, have been there a thousand years. There are, I think, 9 Jews left in Syria. Wow. Most of the Middle East, outside of Israel, everywhere else, you will not find a Jewish community anymore. And for example, in Iraq, from the Babylonian times, Jews had been there from the destruction of the first temple and came back to build the second temple in 70 BCE. So there have always been Jews in the Arab lands. There have always been Jews in the Middle East. There have always been Jews in Israel. Mm-hmm. Always. Right?
Right. Judah. Right. Yeah.
So I think that my father's family, probably after the destruction of the Second Temple, Jews basically scattered. They were exiled by the Romans. They were enslaved by the Romans. There were always Jews in Homs, in Aleppo, in Damascus. You have antiquities, or at least you did. You had kind of Jewish synagogues that were over 1,000 years old in Syria. Many have been destroyed now after the civil war.
Wow. So when they came, now when these Arab Jews came to Israel, were they welcomed with open arms, or was there, I mean, it seemed like there was some discrimination against them as Arabs.
So again, an interesting, a good question. So there were always Sephardic Jews living, for example, in Jerusalem. I don't know if anybody has seen the Beauty Queen of Jerusalem. It's on Netflix, which is a story about Jews from, let's say, Greece, Spain, Turkey, right? Those are Sephardic Jews, meaning like the Spanish lands. And they had been in Israel for, many, 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 many years. Again, before the establishment of the state in 48, there were always Mizrahi Jews, meaning Jews from Arab lands, who would go from Israel and study in Cairo, or go from, when the Ottomans had that part of the empire before the British basically won after the First World War. And then that whole area was broken up between France and Britain, right? After the First World War, it was the British mandate in Palestine. They were also in Egypt. France had Lebanon. And then they created Jordan. Jordan had not been a country before this time. And so there was a lot of upheaval in this period.
So before that time, would you say that people, like the different groups, were more integrated, got along better? And then
not necessarily. No, I'm not. First of all, there weren't as many Ashkenazi Jews. There were a lot of Sephardic and Mizrahi Jews, meaning Jews from Arab lands there and Jews from the expulsion of Spain,
okay,
right?
Right.
So you have, like, in 1492, you have the Inquisition, right? And the Inquisition expels their Jews, or they're forced to convert in Spain. They then move to Portugal. In Portugal, a few years later, there's another Inquisition. They're expelled. They move to Turkey, or they move to Greece. And that is how the Jews of Spain basically are, again, moving eastward.
Okay.
And then many of them also go to Israel. So they, at some point at that time, they felt like they kind of poo-pooed on people from Ashkenazi lands, right? From Eastern Europe, from Russia, who came to Israel very early on in the late 1800s, early 1900s. And they, what was interesting is that they lived with their Arab neighbors. Now, there were riots and pogroms, and there were things that happened between Arabs and Jews. But for a lot of that time, it was, you know, there would be lulls, you know, where things were quiet and peaceful and everything was okay. When my family came from Syria, I have family that came from Syria to Haifa in the 1930s. And they were very close. Their first language was Arabic. They came from Damascus, from the Jewish quarter in Damascus to Haifa. They worked there as merchants with their Arab neighbors. They went to their weddings. They had pretty close relationships with them, right? Culturally, they were very much the same. Religiously, not.
Yeah.
But culturally, they were, right? And so that relationship was fine up until 1948. As soon as 1948 happened, their Arab neighbors no longer wanted to know them. Hmm. And there was a lot of, I guess their Arab neighbors felt betrayed, you know. And so that was a difficult situation, you know. It was very difficult.
Yeah. Is it common to have romantic relationships across that divide, or is this an unusual thing that the story is exploring?
So it has happened. There are people who, you know, there are children who are the products of both Palestinians and Israelis. Some of them live in Israel, like in Jaffa, which is a mixed city, and Haifa, which is another mixed city. Some live in the West Bank, where you have, you know, Jewish women who are married to Palestinian men. Usually that's the way it goes. I think there are these mixed relationships.
Yeah,
I think they're out there, and I think they're important relationships for us, for the world to have and for us to look at to see how they navigate, you know, things like politics.
And are they from both communities considered taboo? Is it, you know, I mean, is it sort of like what it would have been like in the 1950s in the U.S. for a black and a white person to fall in love? Is it that extreme, or is it a little more accepted than that?
I think it depends on the family. There's a very famous Muslim woman, Israeli Muslim. She grew up in Israel. Israeli Muslim woman who is a reporter, you know, is a news reporter for an Israeli TV news show. And she's quite famous. And she's married to a very famous Israeli actor, Jewish. So that is one very prominent, relationship. Now, I believe that both of those families are perfectly fine with it. This is a couple who is, they're out there, you know. They are in the public eye. No one blinks. No one says anything. It's fully accepted. These two are, you know, both of them are powerhouses. I mean, they're really a power couple, right? Mm-hmm. They have a child together. And so it works for them. It works for them because I think they see themselves as Israelis. I don't think they're worried about the religious aspect. And I think that that's the big difference.
Right. Now, of course, that's today. And this book is set in the 60s and 70s. Would it have been more challenging then?
Much more challenging.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not that it didn't happen. I mean, I know of a relationship in my father's family of a Syrian Jewish woman who falls in love with a Syrian Muslim man from a very prominent family. They wind up marrying, and my father's family, they basically sit shiva for her as if she were dead.
Oh, wow.
Right? She was completely excommunicated from the family, completely cut off. She would meet her mother, I think, in the marketplace secretly. The father didn't want to know from her. It was, you know, that was a terrible, terrible situation.
Yeah. Is that part of what maybe inspired you
A little bit, yeah, absolutely. You know, I mean, because you know, it was a family story, and I actually use her name as the cousin that Hadass is going to visit, Badriya. And Badriya is actually the name of this woman, cousin of my father's. You know, I don't know what her last name was or who she married, or I mean, I know who she married, but I don't know the person's name. I know that he was from a very prominent family.
You're listening to Writer's Voices, and our guest today is Ziva Bukai, author of The Anatomy of Exile. So, Ziva, there must have been a lot of stories you could tell about this time period, because there's a lot going on in Israel and the U.S. And so why this particular story?
I started this book 10 years ago, and I hadn't expected that it would come out now at a time where it's, you know, really, really, so difficult, so challenging, and so hurtful. I mean, this is really a very painful time. So I'm hoping that the book is an antidote to that. Mm. That, in a sense, you know, the Romeo and Juliet story is evergreen, isn't it? Right? I mean, we're always rehashing it. It's always coming out. Where people from two different cultures come together and love kind of conquers all. I don't think love conquers all. I think compassion conquers all. I think compassion and empathy for the other, for people who are supposed to be our enemies but are human like us, that is kind of what I was trying to get at in the book. I was also interested in the Ashkenazi-Mizrahi relationship because I grew up in that relationship. My mother was born in 1940 in Siberia at the start of the Second World War. You know, her family were Polish prisoners there, basically. So I wanted to understand how an Ashkenazi Jew and a Mizrahi Jew can be married. Yes, the religion is the same, but the cultures are so different. And again, it's this intercultural issue that I wanted to explore most. And also a marriage. I really feel like this is a story about a marriage, about people keeping secrets from each other, about small betrayals that chip away at trust, at a foundation of trust that we need in order to have a long relationship with someone. And what family means and how outside forces could affect families, how they change them, how they transform them. And also, I wanted to see what it would be like for a mother who's desperate to hold on to her marriage, is desperate to save her daughter from what she perceives is this terrible, terrible threat, because she saw her own sister-in-law, you know, die, right? I mean, she didn't see her die, but
yeah,
she was there in Israel. You know, the story begins with that. And I wanted to talk about love. Mm-hmm. I mean, basically, this is a story about, this is three love stories in this book.
Right, right.
Two between Palestinians and Israelis that bookend the story. And I also wanted to look at the years 1967, during the Six-Day War, which really changed everything on the ground for Israel, and the 1973 war, which was something else that changed everything on the ground for Israel. And so those two wars bookend. The relationships bookend, right? The
right.
Palestinian-Israeli relationships bookend the novel, as well as these wars.
Right, right. And then the kind of the through line is the marriage.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that is the bulk of the story.
Yeah. So you're saying that your parents, your father was, and how do you pronounce it?
Mizrahi.
Mizrahi Jew, yes. And your mother was an Ashkenazi Jew.
Yes.
And how did, were you aware of this distinction as a child?
No, not as a young child, but later on, I saw the difference. And I saw it in the sense that, you know, my grandmother, my mother's mother, was here in the United States when we came. And the majority, the interesting thing was, I should say, that for my father, I think it was, in a sense, more difficult for him to enter kind of American society, even though he had a job here, to enter American Jewish society, he was considered an Arab Jew, right? Because the majority of Jews here in the U.S. at the time were Ashkenazi Jews. Mm. So he was a little different when it came to, you know, to him. And then there was a Syrian community here, and they did not take to him because my mother was Ashkenazi, and they were very insulated. And so you have this, I think that this was a difficult position for him.
So is there, you know, you say there's a cultural difference between the Mizrahi Jewish community and the Ashkenazi Jews. Is there also, is there a class difference distinction made in Israel?
There used to be much more. Like when I was in Israel in the 70s, when I was going to school there, there was definitely a class difference between Mizrahi Jews and Ashkenazi Jews. Ashkenazi Jews were definitely in the upper echelons, and Mizrahi Jews were definitely in the lower echelons. But there was a lot of intermarriage going on. I mean, my parents, my uncle, the two uncles that were with my father at the time that they came to Israel, both of them married Ashkenazi women. And so there's so much intermarriage between those groups that that's one thing that sort of leveled the playing field. The other thing that leveled the playing field is that there is a universal draft in Israel.
Right.
And so everybody goes to the army, and it doesn't matter whether you're, you know, or let's put it this way. It's supposed to not matter whether you're Mizrahi, whether you're Ashkenazi. And I think that in that way also that leveled the playing field, and it took time. But I think nowadays that you have less of a distinction. You know, there is a large majority, more than 50% of Israelis are Mizrahi Jews. So you have a large majority of Mizrahis in Israel, and that really changes the playing field.
Okay. Yeah, I would think so. So why don't you read a little bit from The Anatomy of Exile for us?
I will do that. I'm going to start at the beginning here and just read a few pages of the way the book starts.
Great.
Tel Aviv, 1967. They were on the beach when they heard the news of Hadassah's death. It came over the transistor radio. Her name cut through the surf and salted air that swelled with the gleeful cries of children and ice cream vendors hawking their wares. Salim sank to his knees as the lifeguard's whistle cautioned swimmers to stay close to shore. Tamar drew circles of comfort on her husband's shoulders and whispered that it couldn't be his sister who'd been killed on the bus from Haifa to Tel Aviv. In a daze, they gathered their things, her feet burning as she stumbled after him. They ran past the water spigot and outdoor showers, stopped to slip on their sandals, and lost their towels along the way. They crossed against the light on Ben Yehuda Street. Cars stopped, drivers cursed and shook their fists at them. They charged through the afternoon heat, their breath loud in their ears. Salim was the first to reach their apartment on Frug Street. Tamar was close behind. He tried inserting the key into the lock, but it fell from his hands. She bent to retrieve it and fought the urge to glide her hands up over his body, if only to remind him that they were alive. She opened the door and he staggered ahead. The rooms were dim, light beating through the closed jalousies.
They didn't speak. They didn't strip out of their damp bathing suits or comb their matted hair. He thrust his legs into a pair of trousers and set off for the police station. She watched him from the balcony, his figure receding, and wanted to call him back, afraid he'd disappear like Hadass. When he was gone, she sought the strip of horizon between the Bauhaus buildings, the fresh scar that separated blue sky from bluer sea, then cupped her hands over her ears and imagined waves tumbling onto the shore. She felt the weight of water, the motion of current, its rhythm a steady pulse. She saw Salim as he was that afternoon, powerful, sturdy, as she wrapped her legs around his hips, his feet buried in the silt, their kisses a gentle bumping of teeth and salty tongues, their swim graceful as two seals, their laughter palpating the sky. She tried to recapture the moment before he adjusted the radio dial, and then the beep signaling the hourly news, curdling the day like a spoon of vinegar in a cup of milk. The children came home from camp, their footsteps landing like firecrackers on the floor tiles. She had no idea what to tell them, how much to reveal, and decided to say nothing, to protect them, to protect herself from the impossible task of revealing that their beloved Aunt Hadass was dead. Ari and Rachel, 6 and 7, shouted, "Look, Ima," and held a replica of the Temple Mount in Jerusalem they built out of tongue depressors and bottle caps, their hair black as Selim's sticking to their sweaty faces, their expressions eager and insistent. Ruby 12 dove into her room and slammed the door behind her. Did the driver have the radio on? Could she have heard? Tamar worried. She wrapped her arms around Ari and Rachel, burrowed her face in their necks, and kissed their cheeks until Ari squirmed and wiped his face where her lips had been. "For you," Rachel held out the city. "It's beautiful," Tamar said, lifting it in her arms, eyes stinging. "Where should I put it? Maybe on the table so Baba can see it when he comes home. You hungry? I'll get a snack." She didn't wait for them to answer, merely brushed the hair out of Ari's eyes and walked into the kitchen, the cloud of their disappointment trailing behind her. Everything was as it always was. The knife in the drawer, the bread in the basket. Someone had put the chocolate spread in the refrigerator again. Didn't they know the bread would tear if the chocolate was hard? Her chest ached. She took a deep breath and sliced the loaf. "What's the matter with your sister?" She brought the snack tray out to the balcony, careful not to spill the milk. Rachel shrugged. Ari was preoccupied with a new puzzle. There wasn't room for the tray. A crate of blocks was upended on the floor, a train set knocked on its side. The chaos, a wall she couldn't scale. She placed the tray on a stool. "Don't forget to put those away," she pointed to the blocks. Someone could get hurt. "You all right, Ima?" Rachel asked as Tamar stepped into the living room. Startled, Tamar straightened her back and forced a smile. "Of course. You've got sand on your face," Rachel said. "I do?" Tamar said. "That's funny. I hadn't noticed." She looked at her reflection in the vitrine and saw the tangle of light brown hair that had escaped the long braid, the deep-set brown eyes, and the Slavic cheekbones she'd inherited from her mother, along with the freckles that stretched across her nose. The full mouth seemed to bleed into the rest of her face. "How," she wondered, "could I look the same as I did this morning?" She wiped the sand off. "I'm going to wash up. Thank you, Racheli," she said, and vanished into her bedroom, where she raked her scalp, dragging sand up under her nails, and tried to picture life without Hadass, her dearest friend, her sister-in-law, the family peacemaker, the party coordinator, the light they congregated around. 15 years ago, Hadass had introduced her to Salim and had been smoothing things over between them from the beginning, saying and doing things that made Tamar feel valued and wanted. Now Hadass was killed a month after the Six-Day War. In the weeks leading up to June 5th, when the entire country feared it might not survive, She and Hadass had been inseparable. They shopped for food and necessities, though the supermarket shelves were nearly empty and the Carmel market stalls almost barren. She and Hadass dug trenches in Tel Aviv as part of the city's civil defense preparations. They volunteered at Tel HaShomer Hospital, rolling bandages, preparing beds. They donated blood. As the war drew closer, the government stockpiled coffins, and rabbis sanctified parks as holy ground for emergency burials. Each night after they put the kids to bed, she and Salim sat huddled on the sofa, listening to Radio Cairo. "What are they saying?" she asked. "They're going to annihilate us," he said. 6 nightmarish days of war, and then it was over. The borders had shifted. The world had changed. After 2,000 years of exile, Jerusalem was theirs again. They were humbled, awed, and triumphant. A month later, their bellies were still full of that triumph. They sang and danced in the Kings of Israel Square. Through it all, she'd been aware of Hadassah's unease, the ambivalence of her joy, coupled with her sorrow for a peace that would never be, and later, sympathy for those who had believed their leaders and thought this war would see them back in the villages they'd lost in 1948, as if nothing had occurred, the last 19 years erased.
And that was Ziva Bukai reading from The Anatomy of Exile. You mentioned the draft in Israel. Now, Ruby was living in the United States. Was she still subject to that draft?
As an Israeli citizen, yes. Yes, she would have gotten a notice probably at 17, 17 and a half, something like that. I use kind of literary license to show that she doesn't have her draft yet. Mm-hmm. But normally, yes, if you were born in Israel, you would, at that time, most especially.
And what if you don't want to go? living in another country.
Yes. Yeah. So if you don't want to go and you're living in another country, then you stay in that country. But when you go back to Israel, you've got an issue probably until about the age of 26. After that, they're not terribly interested in you.
Oh, okay.
But between 18 and 26. And I think it's very different today. Back when I was there, you know, I didn't go to the army. I probably should have. I went to school and then, you know, applied for an exemption, which took a while to get. But when I got it, I left Israel and I went back home. You know, I stayed in the States. And went back and forth just for short periods of time, you
okay.
know, more as a tourist.
So as a child, so you came to the U.S. when you were 4.
Right.
Did you go back and forth a lot as a child?
Not at all.
Not.
I didn't go back until I was 17. And that was on an organized tour. A 6-week tour and, you know, with a group of American kids. A lot of us had family in Israel, but I had family there who remembered me from when I was a young, you know, a toddler, mm-hmm. basically. And
so during that whole time, you had not seen your relatives in Israel?
I saw one relative who came to the U.S.
Wow.
We did not have a lot of money. You know, my father went back, you know, because he had close family there. My mother didn't have any family there. Most of my mother's family died in the Holocaust. So she did not, she had one uncle living in New Jersey, and I have a few cousins from, you know, that marriage.
And her mother, you said, was here.
Yes.
Yeah.
Her mother was here.
So why was your mother in Israel and her mother in America?
So my grandmother, so that's a whole other story that I'm kind of writing about now. Too, that I'm very interested in. So My grandmother and my grandfather either left, the story is very murky. They either left Poland or were forced to leave Poland after the Russians came into the eastern part of Poland and the Germans came into the western part of Poland, right? At the beginning, on September 1st, 1939. That was the start of the Second World War. And so these two countries invade Poland, but then Russia, you know, at some point Russia is no longer aligned with Germany and then is fighting Germany as well during the Second World War. But at the beginning of the war, they were aligned. And so
I don't think most of us really realize that.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
So,
it's a good thing they had a falling out.
Yes, it is, because I don't know. I don't know what would have happened in terms. Right. They had a falling out, and then Russia was aligned with the U.S. I don't think a lot of people remember that either.
Well, that I do. I did know.
Yeah.
But I didn't realize that they were initially aligned with Germany.
Yeah. They were initially aligned with Germany. They invade Poland. You know, Russia is the USSR at that time, Russia, right? Greater USSR. So there were many Poles who were deported to Russia. Basically, they were deported into the Soviet Union and enslaved,
right?
Basically, they were put into gulags. And so my mother was born in Orsk, which is right on the border of Siberia. I think they then are forced further into Siberia after that birth. My mother and my uncle grew up in basically in a children's home in an orphanage while my grandmother worked, and she would see them once a week. My grandmother was, again, forced into labor. She was a laundress for the Soviets, washing military uniforms and sheets and whatever else. And they survived, but the rest of her family, who were in Krojnowitz, which is right next to Lodz in Poland, didn't make it. There was a ghetto in Krojnowitz, and then I think they were all sent to either Chełmno or Auschwitz. Mm. And there were 10 children in that family. Only 2 out of the 10 survived, and my grandmother was a twin. My grandfather, so at the end of the war, my grandmother, my grandfather, my uncle, and my mother sort of tried to go back home, but there were now other people living in their house. And they basically traveled around Poland a little bit, applied for visas to Israel after 48, and that's where they went. They went to Israel. It was the only place that would take them where they could stay. After that, my grandmother's brother was able to get married a German woman, made it to America, and then was able to bring my grandmother over. Mm. And from that, she was able to bring my mother and my father, my family over.
Right, right.
And also my uncle's family, because he also married in Israel.
Ah.
So that's kind of how that part of the family, sort of they get to Israel, and my mother and father meet in Tel Aviv.
Right, right. So that's the next book, huh?
I think so. Yeah. I'm not sure. Right now I'm writing these longer stories, and I'm sort of trying to work my way through the weeds of that particular story. And
there's a lot there, obviously.
Yeah. I'm interested in how women grapple with war and how it changes the dynamics in a family.
Mm.
You know, and I have a little bit of that in this book as well.
Right.
I mean, definitely, like how war affects Selene, how the war affects Dawood, who is Hadassah's lover, how it affects Gadi, who's a character who comes in later and is fighting in the 73 war. So there's a lot of that. That's something that I'm really interested in, kind of the psychology of war and the trauma that's left.
You're listening to Writer's Voices. Our guest today is Ziva Bukai, author of The Anatomy of Exile. So you said you worked on this book for about 10 years.
Yes.
So tell me a little bit about your process. Did you like write the whole story and then go back and work it through, or did you or write a little bit and then set it aside and then come back to it?
So, you know, it's really interesting. When I began the story, I began from the point of view of Ruby.
Ah.
And I thought the story that I wanted to tell was the story, and it was a story that I do tell here in this book, but I felt the story I wanted to tell was the one between Faisal and Ruby. When they met, their whole kind of love story development and all of that. And then I felt like that, it didn't feel like enough because I felt the presence of Tamar and Selim there, right, in the background. Mm-hmm. Because Ruby, you know, as a young girl and as a young woman has to deal with her parents. And so then I began telling the story from the point of view of Ruby and the point of view of Tamar. And I was about 2 years in writing alternate chapters between these two characters when a friend of mine said, I hate to tell you, but the more compelling voice is Tamar's voice. And I went, oi. And I thought, okay, what do I do now? And I thought about it for a while and I realized she was absolutely right. The Tamar story felt so much richer to me at the time. This story about a marriage, about how she's dealing with her husband, about, you know, the betrayal that occurs on both their ends.
Yeah.
In writing Tamar's chapters, that's where Hadass sort of developed. Right? That's where that story, that love story, kind of haunts the novel.
So was that not part of it originally? The Hadass
originally
story?
No.
Interesting. No. Okay.
No. Because then I really had to think about, well, what made the family come to America? What's the catalyst here? At first the catalyst was, you know, kind of like my family story. My father wanted to see, could he become, you know, could he live out the American dream? But then I realized, you know, for a novel, you really needed something that was going to propel the story forward. And that's when I thought about Hadass and Daoud. And then there's something else that we actually didn't talk about, and that is the Arab village in this story, Kafr Ma'an.
Yeah.
And Kafr Ma'an is, or Kfar Ma'an, is based on a real Arab village. And the story of the 200 Mizrahi families that were placed on the village in the book is actually what happened in Israel, where this village was abandoned in March 1948, before the War of Independence. They worried that they weren't going to survive. And so the entire village left. You know, there were stories of people leaving their, you know, they left so quickly that they left the food cooking on the stove. You know, there were like these stories. And so the village that had been an Arab village for hundreds of years now was abandoned. And the government, the Israeli government, put 200 Mizrahi families there so that there was, if anybody tried to come back, not that they could, but if they did, there's somebody else living there.
But
the way my grandparents, when they went back to Poland, right, was the
same
thing.
Right. You know? So the Arabs who fled didn't go very far, though, because they would come back to harvest the oranges?
So that, again, was literary license.
Okay.
No, they did not.
Oh, okay.
But they wanted this idea in the novel. No, that absolutely didn't happen.
Okay.
But in the novel, in my imagination, I thought, you know, these people left these orchards here. You know, that longing to be able to till your own land, to, you know, work on your own, basically harvest your own fruit that you had spent, you know, decades cultivating.
Right.
It's
right.
been, you know, really difficult for that generation. And so that was in my imagination, that these people, that this one family, actually, not all of them, but this one family, Dawood Hamid's family, would come back and pick their fruit, right? Mm. And there's that line in the novel, "Remember the sweetness," and it's a line that kind of haunts again, you know, comes back again. So this issue of layers of history, right?
Yeah.
Layers and layers of history.
Now, did you have to do a lot of research to get the, like, the historical part of the novel with the Six-Day War and the 1973 war? And I'm assuming that the demonstration, the Arab demonstration, was a real thing too? Was that wasn't
no,
a real
not,
thing?
Okay. Not at the time.
Okay.
Again, I mean, there have been Arab demonstrations on Nakba Day, right, the day of the catastrophe, and things like that. And there have definitely been Arab demonstrations in Israel. Not just the West Bank, but in Israel proper, for sure. That particular demonstration in the book is one, again, that I made up.
Okay.
So a lot of the book is really fictionalized.
Okay.
But based on certain touch points, right? This idea of the Six-Day War, absolutely that occurred. 73 war, absolutely that occurred. And the way that I tell that particular part of the story, where Tamar hears the news on the radio, is also, I remember that day distinctly. Mm. I think I was 15 years old, and my downstairs neighbor, who was an Israeli guy, had the radio on. And on the corner, there was a little synagogue that, you know, it was like what we call a shtiebel. It was based in somebody's basement, this synagogue. And I just remember, you know, so that scene was very much something that I experienced. Not exactly, it didn't, you know, the way I unfolded in the novel is different, mm-hmm. but again, based on a truth.
Right.
That I remember distinctly.
The descriptions of the apartments and then the house that the family lived in America, were those based on your experience too?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, but also elevated in a way, right? In a sense, like everything gets, like it becomes hyper when you're writing about it, right? Because, you know, sometimes you have dramatic events in your life that are so dramatic that they feel more fiction than fiction, right? Because they're so dramatic.
Yeah, yeah.
But then there are other things that aren't necessarily dramatic and that you need to dramatize. But those apartments, yes, those neighborhoods actually exist. The apartments are a little bit different. I mean, I don't remember, you know, I don't remember the apartment on Avenue C all that clearly because I was a young girl there. But a lot of it, again, is based on my memory of that place.
Now, and are so your parents still living?
No, both of them passed.
So yeah. They didn't get a chance to read this?
No, they didn't. But the book is dedicated to them.
Yeah.
And in their memory.
Did they talk, like, did your grandmother talk about her experience
in Siberia?
In Siberia?
Yes, she did. Not a lot, but she did. And, you know, one of her stories was that she would have to pick potatoes out of the ground. And by the time she would get back to her little hut or barracks or whatever, they were frozen. I mean, she would talk about how cold it was. I mean, people didn't, you know, they died of hypothermia. They died of starvation. They weren't, it wasn't a concentration camp. It was a labor camp, meaning it wasn't a death camp. Mm. They didn't
gas them.
They didn't gas them. Exactly. They didn't gas them. They wanted them for labor.
Yeah.
And that's what they had them for. And if they dropped dead because they were starved or whatever, then they, you know, that was it. They dropped dead.
Yeah.
It was done. But they weren't systematically trying to kill.
Yeah. So, I mean, this book, The Anatomy of Exile, you are showing, I mean, you do, there is some empathy for the Palestinians.
Oh, absolutely.
So how are you feeling about what's going on there now?
I'm crushed. I'm crushed by what's going on there now. October 7th was such a shock. It was so shocking. I think, but even more shocking was what happened here in the U.S. on October 8th. And that was the pro-Palestinian demonstrations and the tearing down of the posters of hostages. 101 are still there. One as young as a year old.
Wow.
So I mean, I don't think I would be writing this book today. On the other hand, I feel that this is the exact book that we need now.
Yeah.
That it's an antidote to what's going on. I sort of feel like if Tamar can grow, then
everybody. Maybe.
That's the case. I don't know what's going to happen. This is a really, it's a dark time.
Yeah.
You know, we're really living through dark times. I have empathy for the Palestinians and I have empathy for the Israelis.
And it is possible to have empathy for both.
Yes.
That's the thing that bothers me the most is people who think that if you empathize with one that you hate the other. That is not true.
No, it isn't. I think we're all smart enough to be able to hold two ideas in our heads at the same time, right? But I think, again, that the only way to move forward is to have empathy and compassion for the other.
Yeah.
I don't think we can do it any other way. And I also think that we have to acknowledge that each of us, each side, has caused pain to the other. Like without saying, I caused you pain, I'm sorry. Without that acknowledgement, it's a self-acknowledgement, right? I think that that's
absolutely,
most important thing. Well,
Ziva, we're out of time, and I found a quote about exile to close with today from Mahmoud Darwish. Exile is more than a geographical concept. You can be an exile in your homeland, in your own house, in a room.
Yes,
and
absolutely.
I think that fits pretty well with this book.
Yes, and Mahmoud Darwish was a wonderful, wonderful Palestinian poet who wrote exquisitely about exile.
Wow. Well, thank you so much for being with us today, and see you all next week on Writers' Voices.
Thank you so much for having me.